Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was a university philosophy teacher before taking up cricket professionally. He captained Middlesex and then played for England, leading the team in 31 test matches. For over 30 years, he's been a psychoanalyst. He's written on and taught psychoanalytical topics and on cricket for The Observer and The Times. He's lectured on topics such as motivation, teams and leadership. His last book was The Art of Captaincy and his latest work is On Form and it's published by Little Brown. Mike Brearley, thanks so much for coming in to speak to me.
Thank you.
Do you remember picking up a cricket bat for the first time?
Well, not for the first time, because I think it was when I was 2 or 3 or 4. My father was a good cricketer, Yorkshireman, played once for Yorkshire and twice for Middlesex. So he was a very, very, very good amateur cricketer. And I grew up with it, that and football. And there is a story, actually, when I was 9, my mother said to me, if you go on like this, you'll do nothing but play cricket and football all your life. When we used to go on holiday to Bognor Regis, which we did for about 10 years, I used to go along the beach finding games of cricket that I could join in on.
So it's always been a passion.
Yes, it has.
And yet it wasn't something that you went into professionally for many years. So tell me about your education and how it led you through.
I went to the City of London School. I did classics, which is Latin, Greek and ancient history. And it was very well taught. And I got into Cambridge and played cricket at Cambridge and did classics part one, which was after 2 years. I had two influences, really, for this switch, which was a switch to philosophy. It's called moral sciences, but it is philosophy. And the first influence was a man called Edward Craig, who fielded at first slip in the cricket team, and I was keeping wicket, and he was doing this moral sciences thing. And he used to allow me to ask, or he would ask, strange philosophical questions like, now, how do we ever know what's going on in the mind of anyone else? Or we can't know the future, can we, and not even the past, and can we know the present? And all sorts of sceptical questions like that, which sort of spurred my curiosity. Mm. And the other person was Renford Bamborough, who taught in the classics department philosophy, Greek philosophy. And he made things that seemed completely crazy sort of thinkable, and also made me want to do it. Mm. And it was through doing philosophy that I first got interested in psychoanalysis. Another teacher, John Wisdom, who wrote a book called Philosophy and Psychoanalysis, and who suggested that in each field there's something similar, that there are things we don't articulate, that we take as basic assumptions, that guide the ways we think, and sometimes lead us to pretty crazy or disturbed or neurotic solutions, in quotes. Mm-hmm. And that the only solution to these things is going over things carefully, saying what one wants to say, and trying to sort out these basic assumptions that take hold of one. And I would say that's true of psychoanalysis and philosophy. But all this is very intellectual. And what I also did when I was at Cambridge was I joined the Samaritans without really quite knowing why. And I found I could listen to people. They didn't ring off. And secondly, I was very curious as to why they were in such a depressed or even sometimes suicidal state.
And so that interest in the workings of the mind has obviously been evident for a long time. And of course, it's something that is enormously relevant in cricket, particularly as a captain.
Yes, it is. And sometimes people say, was your psychology helpful in your cricket? And I think it was. But I think it's also true vice versa. For cricket, especially as you say, as a captain, you have to get into the mind of other people, the opposition, to see where their vulnerabilities are, how you can unsettle them, what they least want, and so on. And your own team, in order to know how to help them more often than hinder them.
But of course, it was a long time before you took up cricket professionally. So take us back to Cambridge and your next steps.
Well, actually, my next step was professional cricket for about a year and a half. I played for Middlesex in the second half of my last year at Cambridge. And then the next year I played as a professional. In the meantime, I'd gone on a tour of South Africa as a young hopeful. I didn't do very well, but that's another story. And I was torn between whether to carry on playing cricket professionally or to try and do this philosophy thing, or maybe to go into the civil service was another possibility. And I was really uncertain. And it took me a long time to know what I really wanted. So I then went back to philosophy. I did postgraduate work. I never finished my PhD, but I got a job teaching philosophy at Newcastle University, which I did for almost 3 years. And for that 5 years or so, or 6 years, I didn't play much cricket. I played a bit in the holidays. I played club cricket at the weekends. But I didn't play top-level cricket much. And I don't think that helped my batting, but maybe it helped in other ways.
Making you an excellent captain, because, of course, then you were called up again.
Yes, having played a bit for Middlesex, second team and sometimes the first team, during the summer holidays of these philosophy years, I was then asked if I was interested in captaining Middlesex. And at that time, I also realised I wasn't really an academic.
How do you realise that?
Well, I liked teaching. I liked the students. I liked my colleagues. Sometimes I got interested in some of the ideas I did, but I didn't really have that drive to spend a lifetime working out philosophical conundrums and difficulties. It didn't quite feel right for me. You know, the timing was very lucky because I was attracted by the idea of captaining Middlesex.
Interesting you use the phrase working out, because presumably your level of fitness, you had to maintain that all that time that you weren't playing. Were you in fact working out?
Well, in those days, you know, cricketers weren't, there wasn't much emphasis on fitness. If you owned a tracksuit when I first played, you were thought pretentious. You turned up for a few nets at the beginning of the season, you batted and you bowled, you did a little bit of close catching or running around and throwing the ball in, and that was about it. And, I mean, the great players, like Dennis Compton in particular, would come in, borrow someone's bat, come in at 5 o'clock in the morning from a night out and score 100 on his first outing, you know. But that was not the case for everyone.
But that whole thing of being called up for Middlesex while you're doing something else, I mean, that's unthinkable now, really, isn't it?
Everyone is more professionalised, more training, more fitness, as you imply, more coaching, more all-round the year contracts. Mm. In those days, the contracts were probably 6 months. Mm. So everyone did something else in the winter. And I did something else until the end of the term, in the summer term in Newcastle in the end of June. And then I might go back to London and might go on holiday first to Florence. I once came back from Florence on a Monday or a Tuesday with a message, would I play for Middlesex on Wednesday? See, against Lancashire, who had two England bowlers, Shuttleworth and Lever. And I opened the batting and I said to Mike Smith, my partner, what do these blokes do, you know? And he said, well, they don't swing the ball away. And then second ball swung away. I got an edge and I was out for naught. But it wasn't always quite like that either.
So 68 was around about the time when you became very aware of South Africa and the problems there. Tell me about your stand against apartheid.
Well, it grew out of the Dolivira affair. The Dolivira affair was a Cape Coloured, as he was called.
Which is mixed race.
Race from the Cape area near Cape Town. And he was a terrific cricketer who played on second-rate pitches and still scored lots and lots of runs and took lots of wickets. And he was brought over to England by John Arlott, who was a cricket correspondent for The Guardian and the voice of cricket for BBC. And he played in the leagues, the Lancashire leagues, and then he, after doing a qualifying residential period, he played for Worcestershire in county cricket. And he got picked for England, and the story is, and I'm sure it's true, that he said he was 31 when in fact he was about 37 or something, and he went on playing till his mid-40s. And he was playing, the series was against Australia in 1968, I think, in England. And he played in the first test and he took some wickets but didn't get many runs and was dropped for the next 4 tests. And the last test came up at the Oval just before they were going to select the team to go to South Africa, apartheid South Africa. And in the second innings of that match, he scored 131, I think it was, and he was not selected for the England team 2 or 3 days later. And it didn't smell quite right. Mm. And a group of people, members of the MCC, who were in the end responsible for tours in those days, despite being a private club, now they're not, but they were then, got together having similar feelings to each other, one of whom was the Reverend David Shepherd, who played cricket for England and was by then the Bishop of Woolwich, I think, before he became Bishop of Liverpool. And we got the number of signatories required and called a special meeting to protest against the MCC's handling of this situation, by which we primarily meant that knowing that they had D'Oliveira in or on the fringe of the team, they should have found out in advance that any team they picked would be acceptable to South Africa. And they didn't do that. So there was this great ignorance about what would happen if he was picked, and great suspicion when he wasn't picked, that something had been done to preserve the tour at the expense of the person, at the expense of the England team, for that matter. And so we did that, and we lost the vote, but David Shepherd proposed the motion. I seconded it. We were confronted a few weeks before by Sir Alec Douglas-Hume, who'd flown down specially from Scotland to tell us how stupid we were and ignorant about politics, and wanting us to call the whole thing off, which we refused to do. And we found out much later that people in the MCC had known that if D'Oliveira was picked, the tour would be cancelled. Or at least they got a pretty good idea of that. So that was the stance we took. And then immediately, as a result of that, or following on from that, Peter Hain was leading Stop the Tour, which was about cricket and rugby, and banning South Africa from, while it was an apartheid country, from international sport. And I went to at least one, I think more than one of his meetings, though I wasn't in favour of what the more proactive members of his supporters were doing, you know, sitting on pitches, digging up pitches, more active. But I was a sort of rather timid version of that. And it wasn't very popular in the cricket world because many people earned their living from going to South Africa and coaching, and people liked the tours with South Africa, and it was very pleasant and comfortable.
But of course it didn't negatively impact on your career. You captained England.
I mean, I think, to be fair, nobody held it against me in the long run. It was just, there was some discomfort at the time. And I was slightly, since I was at the university in Newcastle, I was slightly insulated from that. So it was easier for me. And my friends at the university were more likely to be anti-apartheid than some of the cricketers who had an interest in the matter as well.
Leading a movement like that and captaining a cricket team obviously all require the skills that you had been building up for a very long time. At what point did you start thinking about psychoanalysis as a career?
I thought about it in the mid-60s, actually, but again, no real experience. I'd never known a psychoanalyst. I'd never been a patient. I hadn't known any patients. So I was really talking off the top of my head or from reading Freud or whatever it was. But I did want to find out how you trained as a psychoanalyst. And I got the impression, falsely, from an analyst I was sent to see, that he himself had done history at Oxford and had then trained as a doctor and has then trained in psychiatry and then become a psychoanalyst. And I actually couldn't envisage such a journey from the age of 25. It would take me till I was about vast age of 35 or something. I didn't want to do that. So I rather gave up on it for a while. And so then in the early 70s, I found a job in the winter, the 6 months I wasn't playing cricket, working as a nursing assistant at the Northgate Clinic for Adolescents in North London. And that was a fascinating experience for me. I did it for 2 winters. And it was run along psychotherapeutic, indeed psychoanalytic lines, really. All the inpatients had 3 times a week intensive therapy. There were small groups and there was a large group. So I really got into it then, and that's when I decided I wanted to do something in this field.
When you applied to train, you were initially knocked back for having no leadership experience.
No, it wasn't for having no leadership experience. It was for having no experience or not enough experience with people who were mentally or emotionally disturbed. This was a Swiss analyst I mention in the book. And she thought that cricket, she couldn't think, she probably didn't know what cricket was, but she certainly didn't think it was particularly relevant for psychoanalysis or psychoanalysts. And she came back to me a few weeks later and wrote very charmingly saying some of her English colleagues on the admissions committee had said it was more relevant than she'd understood, or it might be. So I could carry on with my application.
All of this going on, and then your psychoanalysis coming together. And of course, what that has produced is two tremendous works, which make us understand, really, I suppose, how relevant sport is to absolutely every sphere of our lives.
I'm glad you think that.
So your first book, The Art of Captaincy, really about leadership and how to bring the best out of people.
Yes, I always say there are two strands, main strands to leadership. One is technical. So in cricketing terms, it's tactics, strategy, setting the right fields, changing the bowling, doing all those things shrewdly and well. And that's a skill in itself. And often uncertain, just as in neurosurgery, a lot of that's uncertain. But the second thing is what you say. It's trying to get the best out of people, trying to get people to play as a team. So you're interested in the whole well-being of the team, but also of the individuals within it. Mm. And getting that balance between a necessary selfishness, you know, ambition and selfishness. You have to score runs, you have to take wickets, and a necessary broader view and broader allegiance to the whole team.
Because it does seem to me, as not a cricketer, that it's a very gladiatorial game and that actually you are out there on your own in quite a hostile environment.
Oh, it is. You're talking about batting, really, because the batsman's facing this man with a 5.5-ounce missile that he hurls sometimes at 90 or 95 miles an hour, sometimes at your head or body, and sometimes an intimidating crowd and opposition around you. So you're quite right, it is. So actually, at the same time, you're one of 11 people. You're playing, and the whole context of the game makes a difference to that individual duel, those individual duels. So it's an interesting game in that it's more like everyday life, you know, that we're all part of collectives of one kind or another, groups, teams, companies, families, partnerships, work groups, and so on. And so we have to look after ourselves. Sometimes we're the only people who will do much of that. Mm. And we have to look after other people and the whole group as well.
So understanding that group dynamic, as somebody who hasn't studied psychoanalysis, how do we ordinary people get into that state?
It's very tempting, as we all know, for groups to become tyrannically led, with power having an undue influence. And sometimes the groups can be led by blocks of power within the group, sometimes apparently lowly people, you know, so that the children in a family can become extremely powerful, almost tyrannical over the whole family. But of course, so can the parents very easily. To my mind, a good team is a good democracy. But it has a hierarchy as well, hopefully a flat enough one, so that people are free enough and confident enough and given space enough to offer their views and opinions, even when they disagree with powerful people around. I mean, we see it at the moment in all these issues about the Houses of Parliament and abuse, sexual and other kinds of bullying that can go on in organisations. It's so easy for them to go on. And it can happen in teams too.
And how would you then relate that? I mean, you're talking about Westminster and what's happening there, and I wonder how you would relate this then to what's happening in the United States and the leadership there and the way that Donald Trump then relates to the rest of the country.
He relates on a very different model from the one that I would advocate. He relates on the basis that you've got your friends and you keep them happy and you menace and threaten and sue and attack anyone who opposes you in any way whatever. There's very little in the way of negotiation, of give and take, of understanding that one only has part of the answer oneself and that other people have part of the answer. Sometimes it's you have to choose one or the other. I'm not saying it's all agreeable, and sometimes you're going to have arguments and disagreements. That's what I see him as being, a bully.
Your next book, and indeed it's come out fairly recently, is called On Form. And tell us what being on form means to you.
Again, everyone recognises it. You know pretty much when you're on form yourself, and you know pretty much when you see somebody playing, working in a family when they're on good form too. On the other hand, you can sometimes misjudge your own form. But I think it's to do with things being in balance, having a certain resilience, because you have to be on form it applies to a period of time, not an instant. You can play brilliant shots at cricket, say, and be out next ball or not be on very good form. So it requires a certain resilience to get you through sticky periods or periods when the odds are against you or the bowling's very excellent and you're at the limit of your ability if you're playing the piano or whatever you're doing. But it's also, we can see it in a, I have an image in the book of a sailing ship, an old sailing ship with the sails all beautifully, tightly out, catching the wind in perfect trim, ship shape, as we say. So I think we recognise form. It's a bit different from being in the zone, which is more like, I say it's more like being in love than having a good friendship, because it's very exciting. Everything feels, you can feel you can do anything. And it's got its dangers for that reason. But of course, those are moments that we also value, the moments of being in the zone where it feels as though we're not simply controlling what goes on, but we're being taken over by something bigger than ourselves. And we are almost instruments in the hands of that something. It's more like being inspired.
But you point out in your book that whole love feeling, and indeed in real love, can be a folie à deux, that we get into just deluding each other.
It can. And it can be a folie à un as well, just for one person. I mean, it can be, you can begin to feel you can do anything at all and you lose all proper caution. There's a story in the book about Ayrton Senna, the Formula One racing driver, who went round a practice run at Monaco, I think it was, went round 2 seconds faster than anyone else, which apparently is, you know, a lot faster. And he said it was as if the car and he were one. Mm. He'd never been at this level before. And in the next sentence he said, and so I didn't do any more driving that day. There was no proper caution. I wasn't fit to drive. That puts it beautifully, the risk.
So when you started just to be a psychoanalyst, how difficult was it to walk away from cricket?
Well, I was 40 and I'd had a good run at it and I was getting a bit tired. And I don't mean mentally, I mean physically. And I'd been planning it for 2 or 3 years, this timing. I'd started to train as a psychoanalyst and that was extremely difficult like cricket and extremely interesting like cricket. I'd got a new family and all those things helped. I mean, there were days, nice sunny days when, let's say, Middlesex were playing Surrey or Yorkshire, old rivals, you know, when I thought, gosh, it would be nice to be out on that field again, battling it out. But it wasn't, I had enough going on in my life. I was fortunate.
How different then is your day to day? I mean, obviously not nearly so physical, but in terms of managing people?
Yes, it's a very nice question. I mean, occasionally there's a real overlap. Like sometimes one or somebody else, a captain or somebody else in the team, makes a comment, which is quite like a psychoanalyst's comment. He makes a comment about what's going on in the team, what the atmosphere is like in the team. Roland Butcher did it once, you know, that we're all talking as if we've got 4 trophies on our mantelpiece at the end of the season and we've stopped really paying attention to ball-by-ball events or session-by-session events. My editor for the book, which is not a psychoanalytic job, but he would say things to me that were not unlike my analyst, you know, that you, why won't you put yourself in the story? Or do you have to be so intellectual? Or does everything have to be a lecture? Or he would say things like that, which make you think about the way you're doing something and make you rethink it. So sometimes the thinking is not unlike, I mean, there's an amusing fact, to me amusing, that there's big arguments in cricket about the prioritisation of 5-day test cricket or 2020 3-hour matches, and which is going to win out and become more popular and more prevalent. And the same argument happens in psychoanalysis because traditionally it was 5 days a week. And of course, people don't have time or money for that or attention span. And so there are big arguments about, is that the best form? Are other forms inferior forms? Or is it in fact important for psychoanalysis to adapt and include T20 versions of itself?
Mm. And is it?
I think it struggles to, and of course there's room for both, but I also think that psychoanalysis needs to find ways of being able to bring help to people, including, say, in the National Health Service, even where there's no or almost no chance of people having full analysis paid for by the government lasting for 4 or 5 years. And that is, I think, in drawing out from, let's say, doctors, nurses, social workers, people working in the hospital, occupational therapists, etc., something of the psychological impact of illness and the psychological impact of illness on physical, of mental states of mind on physical. And sometimes understanding better, particularly in psychiatry, but also in other forms of medicine, understanding what's going on in people.
There does seem to be, I mean, all the papers report on it, and certainly when we look at the rise in terror, where many of the people perpetrating these terrible acts appear to have mental health problems, yeah. It does seem that this is becoming much more prevalent, or are we just more aware of it?
I think we're more aware of it. I don't know if it's more prevalent. I just don't have any idea. What is very difficult is long-term finding and putting money into long-term solutions. And when you think about the reduction in intensive child psychotherapy along analytic lines, I would say, young children, that's the most formative time. It's the time when the patterns get most established of behaviour and attitude and orientation and indeed disturbance, that it's shocking that it's being reduced rather than enhanced.
Of course, you speak a lot about this and you write about it. You've written these two wonderful books. With all of this stuff going on in your life, where do you find the time to write the books? And do you have a kind of particular writing process?
My wife is Indian and she's been in England for 40 years to be with me, and we've gone for Christmas and so on. But we've started to go for a bit longer and I'm now semi-retired. And I've arranged my practice rather differently, and people know about this now. We go for about 2 or 3 months to India. And actually, that is a very good time for writing, because I don't have much in the way of formal work. I do a little bit on Skype one day a week, but it's not as much as I do here. And there are fewer things going on in my life in general.
The cricketers that I have interviewed, and I've been lucky enough to speak to a few, all seem to be fantastically bright with a huge amount going on in their lives. I mean, you point out in your book that having a hinterland is so important. But I wonder what it is about cricketers in particular who all seem to have double firsts from Oxbridge.
I don't know what the answer is. I mean, you do have to have a certain long attention span. If you're going to play professional cricket with matches that last 3, 4, 5 days, or even whole day matches in club cricket or school cricket, there is this interesting complexity of being a member of a whole team of 11 people or a squad of 16 or whatever, and at the same time being on your own, as you said earlier, and having to work it out for yourself. I hope that sport, and cricket in particular, can develop the person as well as develop them as a cricketer.
If there was one takeaway from your latest book on form, what do you think it would be?
Well, I think it's a very difficult question. And one of the things I say about the book is it's not 10 tips for being on form, because I don't think form's that kind of a thing any more than health is something you could say. I think that one of the things is that if we're off form, there's probably a reason that has something to do with our psyches, ourselves, our personalities or our emotional state. And so if we can, in a kindly to ourselves way, get to know ourselves a bit better, this might improve our form in the long run. But of course, people want quick fixes for sport. That's not a quick fix. We're complicated beings. We've got lots of unconscious elements or self-deceiving elements. We've all got that to cope with. But on the whole, I think self-knowledge, understanding, knowing yourselves helps you be on form more reliably.
And to get to know you, of course, all we have to do is read this book, because as well as your wonderful and coherent thoughts about being on form, there are some beautiful stories, beautifully illustrated in a literal form. It's a beautiful read.
Oh, thank you very much.
Mike Brearley, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Mike Brearley's book On Form is published by Little Brown. It's out now. My name's Georgina Godwin. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. My thanks to George McDonough and David Stevens.